There's so much to look forward to in 2026 on the ABC.
Yes. Phenomenal.
Just you wait.
With new drama, Goolagong.
She's a natural.
Brand new dog park.
It's a shame we can't be more like them, isn't it?
I'm happy with a handshake.
A new take on a 90s classic.
Welcome to Race Around the World.
And new seasons of old favourites, like Austin, The Piano.
Give me more of that.
Grand Designs Transformations and Muster Dogs.
This brings things into focus, doesn't it?
This is fabulous.
So much to look forward to.
That's 2026.
It's a spectacular time.
On ABC TV and ABC iView.
From Wurundjeri country, I'm Lexi Junawick, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese defiant in face of growing calls for a federal royal commission into the Bondi terror attack. We speak with opposition frontbencher Senator James Patterson.
I think it's a patronising, presumptuous and offensive argument that has been directly and explicitly rejected by the families of the victims of the Bondi terrorist attack.
Then you'll hear the fascinating and at times heartbreaking story of the Dionne quintuplets following the death of the last of the famed five identical sisters.
It was essentially a human zoo where people would come and they would look through one-way glass at the children if they were playing or studying or whatever they were doing. And it became a massive tourist attraction. Thousands of people were going there every day.
From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Anthony Albanese has released the terms of reference for a review into the Bondi Beach terror attack to probe the actions of law enforcement and intelligence agencies. But the PM continues to sidestep calls for a full Commonwealth Royal Commission, drawing criticism from the opposition, which, as you'll hear in this next interview, shows no sign of slowing down. Here's host Barbara Miller speaking with Shadow Minister for Finance, James Patterson.
You said that the government fears its own failings and inaction would be exposed by a royal commission. Before any review has been undertaken, are you clear what those failings, in your view, are?
Yes, I think it's been clear from the 8th of October when we had a rally in Western Sydney where an imam said that this is a day of celebration and a day of pride, that the Prime Minister has failed to grasp the seriousness of the anti-Semitism crisis. Almost everything the government has eventually done on anti-Semitism, they've had to be dragged kicking and screaming to doing by the Jewish community, by the media and the opposition. Things like banning the public display of flags of listed terrorist organisations, they had to be dragged into doing. Things like toughening our incitement to violence laws federally because no hate preacher had been prosecuted, they had to be dragged kicking and screaming to doing. Things like toughening our visa screening and cancellation powers for the Home Affairs Minister, the Jewish community and the opposition have been calling for over a year, and finally, only after Bondi, they've done it. So it's very clear that even the things the Albanese government has done on this has been too little and too late, and there are many things that they're yet to do.
You also said the government was gaslighting the victims of Bondi, a pretty emotive language. What exactly did you mean by that?
Well, I've used that terminology, but much more important than me, families of victims and rabbis have used that language too. And what I meant by that is yesterday at this press conference, Tony Burke implied that you couldn't have a judge oversee a royal commission because it was too sensitive. I mean, that displays either breathtaking ignorance of the history of the intelligence community or willful gaslighting of the Jewish community and survivors, because judges are exactly the kind of people that we appoint to oversee royal commissions into the intelligence community. In fact, Labor governments, the Whitlam government and the Hawke government, appointed Justice Hope to conduct two royal commissions into the intelligence community. Tony Burke also implied that you couldn't have a royal commission into the intelligence community because it was too sensitive and it might be public. Again, in our history, on multiple occasions, we've appointed former judges to hold inquiries into the intelligence community, and they've handled that. I mean, at this very time, at this very day, there are judges who will be considering applications for warrants from the federal police for foreign interference, for espionage, and for terrorism, and they're briefed to highly sensitive classified material in order to grant those warrants. So if Tony Burke doesn't trust judges to do that, then he's actually arguing for a radically different justice system in Australia.
Now, I'll just read you a text that's come in on the text line as we sort of continue with this discussion, I guess, every day about a royal commission. Given the government has repeatedly said now it won't be holding a royal commission, is the opposition simply politicising this tragedy by continuing with this request?
No, I don't agree. And when he was in opposition, the opposition leader, Anthony Albanese, campaigned for many royal commissions. He's been in favour of royal commissions into the banking sector, into veterans, into disabilities, into the aged care sector, into robo-debt and many other things. He even commissioned a former High Court judge to look into the Morrison government's practice of appointing multiple ministries. All of those things apparently warranted a royal commission in Anthony Albanese's view. But our worst ever terror attack, which is the culmination of 2.5 years of shocking anti-Semitism, doesn't justify a royal commission in his view. We're going to continue to hold his feet to the fire on this. We're going to hold him accountable for this. And we're going to stand with the Jewish community, who are so clear from every representative body in the Jewish community, whether it's the Executive Council of Australian Jewry, whether it's the Zionist Federation, whether it's the Rabbinical Association. Every single one of them is calling for a royal commission, along with the victims, and we stand with them.
Shadow Minister for Finance, James Patterson. Staying with the Bondi attack, and Christchurch in New Zealand faced its own reckoning on racial and religious hatred in wake of the 2019 murders of 51 people inside two mosques by Australian Brenton Tarrant. A royal commission spent 18 months hearing evidence on gun control, security intelligence, counter-terrorism and social cohesion, with Chair Sir William Young calling his recommendations the building blocks for a safer and more cohesive New Zealand. So did the process make New Zealanders safer? Barbara spoke with Raf Manji, a former Christchurch City Councillor who worked closely with the victims in wake of the 2019 attack.
You were working closely with victims in the weeks after the Christchurch attack. You conducted your own inquiry into how compensation funds should be distributed. What were those hearings like for victims and their families?
Look, I think the important thing here, and I mean, you know, I've been listening to a little bit of the conversation around a proposed royal commission, which I would completely support. I'm kind of surprised the government hasn't moved to that. You know, public reassurance after an event like this is absolutely critical. And part of that is the ability for the affected community to have their say and be listened to. It's absolutely critical. If you don't do that, this will just continue for years and years. So, you know, it was a very difficult process. People were in a lot of pain, a lot of suffering, a lot of anxiety, but the process is worth going through, and it is really important. And I think people do feel safer after just being able to express how they feel. We had the issue of Islamophobia here. Obviously, in Australia, you have the issue of anti-Semitism. I've been watching that. There are a lot of similarities. It's almost like we've got a kind of reverse situation. But it is important to go through these steps. And I think both the Royal Commission we had here and the listening project that I ran separately with the victims was really important for people to be reassured.
And of course, there was also the sentencing of the gunman. Did victims reflect on that as a chance where they got to talk about the pain inflicted on them?
Yeah, absolutely. And that you know, these things do take time. So the sentencing of Brenton Tarrant was, I think, October 2020. So it was some sort of 18 months after the event. But all the victims were allowed to present victim impact statements directly. I mean, I have to say the court process that was run here was really, really good. It was very open. It was very sensitive. And we, I think, had 3 days of victim impact statements, which was, you know, quite incredible. And the courts were very flexible around that, how people approached it. I think I did 4 myself, 4 victims and survivors who didn't want to speak themselves but wanted their words to be heard. And that's really, really important. So there is a big process that you need to go through after an event like this. The you shouldn't underestimate the trauma, not just in the victim group but also the wider community as well, and for people to see that it is being taken, you know, seriously.
The Prime Minister here has said that a Royal Commission would delay the response. The report of the Christchurch Royal Commission was handed down 18 months after the attack. What do you make of that argument from Australia's Prime Minister?
Look, I can understand that, but there are ways around that. And the simple way to approach it is you have staggered reporting. I mean, I think you have to have a Royal Commission because you need the wide access to powers to investigate, and you need a judge to oversee it. We had a sitting Supreme Court Justice, Sir William Young, and that's really critical because I've seen the appointment of a former bureaucrat, and I think, you know, you need somebody who's completely independent because, you know, there will be things to look at here, even looking from the outside. And yes, the engagement with the community can take some time. Our report was a little bit more complex in that there was a lot of time spent on tracking the movements of Tarrant over the years, and so there was a lot of travel. I don't think that's going to be the case for what's happened in Sydney. And yes, if the intelligence aspect can be done quicker, then that report can be released. But I think you need it within the framework of a Royal Commission, and you just have staggered reporting rather than waiting to the end. So there's probably a lot that you can learn from our experience here, and I'm sure the people involved in the Royal Commission report here will be very happy to share their experiences and what they could have done differently and how they could have maybe done things a little bit quicker. So, you have to have a Royal Commission. I don't think there's any other option.
Parts of your Royal Commission were suppressed for 30 years to protect national security. How was that received by families? Did they accept that readily?
Look, I mean, they were not happy about it, to be frank, because there was always with Tarrant here, and, you know, probably with the terrorists in Sydney, there's a sense that, you know, was there a failure in intelligence? And let's face it, you know, the primary role of any government is the protection of its citizens. And so the fact that there is a terrorist attack is a failure of intelligence. And so there were sort of people in the community who thought, are we being told everything? Is the government covering things up? But I think essentially there was acceptance that, okay, this was just part of the process. People weren't happy about it. But that's the reality of an investigation like this. You just have to hope that no stone is unturned, and anything that needs to be done gets done. I mean, I think on the whole, it was pretty transparent, our process here, and the agencies have been pretty open. People draw their own conclusions from the reports. Obviously, governments, you know, always like to say there's nothing that could be done, and obviously there were things that could have been done. But I think overall, it was a good process, and the community was relatively satisfied by it.
Former Christchurch City Councillor Raf Manji there. Varroa mite is a tiny parasitic pest that attacks honeybees, weakens entire colonies, and can cause hives to collapse if it's left unmanaged. It's considered the most serious threat to honeybees worldwide, and after spreading across parts of eastern Australia, 2025 marked its detection in the Australian Capital Territory, with authorities there warning it could wipe out around half of the ACT's beehives over the next 2 years. The spread of varroa is forcing beekeepers to rethink how they manage hives and raising broader concerns about food production, pollination and biosecurity. Kit Prendergast is a bee scientist and ecological entomologist with the University of Southern Queensland. Barbara spoke with her.
What is it and why is it such a serious threat?
So it's a parasitic mite, and fortunately for biodiversity, only impacts the European honeybee, Apis mellifera, and it can also spread viruses when it infects the honeybees, and it causes, losses and potential, losses of the whole colony. It has spread across the world, and until 2022, Australia was one of the only countries that didn't have varroa, but now we do. And it has caused large colony losses, but there is no risk of it actually causing the extinction of honeybees. So it is, however, a serious, threat to beekeepers' livelihoods and also pollination services of our major crops.
Yes, so authorities in the ACT saying up to half of the hives could be lost within 2 years. What would the impact be there in terms, for example, of pollination?
One thing about honeybees that's relatively good is that although there can be large losses, beekeepers can make up for these losses by splitting hives, increased queen breeding. So these losses, they can be, you know, compensated for, but in the short term, it could mean increased food prices as well, because there are managed honeybees and there's also feral honeybees. And managed honeybees are better off because if beekeepers look after them, make sure there's no nutritional stress, make sure they check their hives regularly to, you know, detect any varroa as soon as it gets there. You know, the hives can be okay, but the feral honeybees, they can decline, and that means that pollination services that were performed largely by feral honeybees, farmers might be paying beekeepers to perform the pollination services, and that will, you know, increase the cost of food. It depends upon the crop as well. Some of our crops rely more on flies, for example, for pollination. But yeah, we can expect to see potential increase prices in some food crops.
And now that it seems to be spreading, do you think there's a worse situation ahead for Australia?
So like most diseases or parasites, when it first hits what we call naive population, there's a big spike in mortality. But over time, like we can see in other countries, the situation will sort of reach a balance because parasites, they actually don't want their host to go extinct, because then they would as well. So we'll probably see, you know, as it spreads across the country, and, you know, it still hasn't reached WA, which is a, you know, very big stronghold for honeybees. There is that, you know, intervening desert. But there will initially be big losses, and then as we adapt our honeybee practices, as there's better biosecurity and management, as well as the bees themselves adapt evolutionarily, there'll be a balance. And we can see that overseas, that there can be losses, especially when there's other compounding threats like, you know, drought, or the bees being trucked from like one monoculture to another monoculture to another one, which can be quite stressful for them. So yeah, we will probably see big losses at the start, and then it will balance out. Even in the US, for example, where they can have you know, up to 40% colony losses, these actually are then, you know, compensated by beekeepers splitting hives or bees moving in from other areas. So globally, the number of honeybee colonies are increasing. So you actually don't have to be concerned that this is going to wipe out honeybees. And there is a silver lining here, in that the decrease in feral honeybees can actually give our native pollinators a bit of respite from competition.
Bee scientist Kit Prendergast. Turning overseas now, and when the Dion sisters were born in small town Canada in 1934, no one thought they would survive. Quintuplets, five identical girls, arrived at the height of the Great Depression. But against all odds, the Dion girls lived, becoming the first quintuplets in recorded medical history to survive infancy. They became global sensations, but their lives were also marked by exploitation after they were removed from their family and installed in a tourist attraction dubbed Quintland. Now, the last surviving Dion quint has died. Annette Dion was 91. For more on this incredible story, Barbara spoke with Craig Baird. He's the host of the Canadian History X podcast.
Paint me a picture, if you would, of the time and place that the Dion girls were born into.
Well, when they were born in 1934, it was kind of the heart of the Great Depression for Canada. And, you know, people were kind of looking for some kind of big news story, some good news story. And the survival of these five girls, you know, when they were born, the quintuplets, was kind of a huge story and something that a lot of people latched onto. I mean, the girls were famous pretty much from the moment they were born, as soon as news got out.
And then at some point, they were actually removed from their families. Why was that?
So they were born in the province of Ontario, and the Ontario government ruled that they were being exploited by the family. So they passed what was called the Dion Quintuplets Guardianship Act in 1935. And like I said, their goal was to prevent their exploitation, but then they did exactly that by exploiting the children and creating Quintland. And it was essentially a human zoo where people would come and they would look through one-way glass at the children if they were playing or studying or whatever they were doing. And it became a massive tourist attraction. Thousands of people were going there every day. And at one point, it was a bigger tourist attraction in Canada than Niagara Falls. And it was making the Ontario government millions of dollars every year.
And the doctor who helped birth them, he too became a celebrity. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Dr. Alan Defoe, he, you know, credit where credit is due, he did ensure that they survived, which was not easy, especially in the 1930s. And then he became very famous because people wanted to know more about him and how he was able to ensure their survival. And he made millions of dollars off of them. And movies were made that starred the Quints, and they would have a character based off Dr. Defoe. And there was eventually kind of a council made that was supposed to oversee the children, and he was on it until he was removed from it because he was starting to profit so much from it.
And the parents eventually got custody back of the girls. What happened then?
Well, unfortunately, it wasn't a very happy reunion for the families because the girls have essentially grown up in a very sheltered, constructive environment inside of the Quintland. So when they were returned to their families when they were about 10 years old or so, they were going into a family they barely even knew. The family spoke French, they spoke English, and they were very much treated like outsiders. And they eventually wrote a book about their experiences and their tales of abuse and things like that. For the girls in the family. And eventually when they turn 18, they kind of just go their own way and leave their family behind because the family in many ways, even though they were making so much money off of them, also resented the children.
And then in later life, they took action, didn't they, over the abuse that they'd suffered?
Absolutely, yeah. So there was a trust fund that was created for the Quints when they were children and all this money was being put into it. But unfortunately, people were also dipping their hands into it and taking money out. So by the time they turned 18, there was very little left over for them. And one Quint, Marie, she died in 1950 when she was in a convent. Another died in 1974. So the last of the Quints, Yvonne, Cecile, and Annette in the 1990s launched a lawsuit against the Ontario government to be able to get some money back. And the Ontario government offered about $2,000 a month, and they flatly refused that. And eventually they were awarded a few million dollars and got an official policy. But the three Quints lived together until eventually they all passed away over the course of about 20 years in the 21st century.
Craig Baird, host of the Canadian History X podcast. Well, that's about all we've got time for on The Breakfast Wrap today. Every interview was presented by Barbara Miller and produced by the Radio National Breakfast Team. The Breakfast Wrap was produced by Josie Scott. I'm Lexi Junowick. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll be back with a New Year's Eve edition of The Wrap tomorrow.